is CBS Eye on the World. Here's John Batchelor.
Ukraine crisis at the same time as European crisis. We read in the Telegraph reporting from London, recession looms after UK economy shrank in March. From Germany, German gas supply drops as Ukraine shuts off pipes from Russia. From the markets in London, the FTSE 100 drops 2%. Germany's economy minister, Robert Habeck, commenting, accused Russia of weaponizing energy supplies as he described new sanctions imposed by the Kremlin as an escalation. This is the energy weapon. At the same time, there is the weapons of war. And we note that along with these headlines about the European economy troubled is the headline that Finland and Sweden are in train to join NATO. They're members of the EU now, but to join NATO, expanding the frontier facing Moscow several hundred miles. At the same time, two countries that have been decidedly neutral since the Second War have now moved into the camp of NATO for protection. Or I note that the United Kingdom's Prime Minister Boris Johnson made it very clear that there's an alliance with Sweden and Finland and that UK troops could be stationed there. I remind everyone that the United Kingdom, along with France, is a nuclear power. I welcome Judy Dempsey of the Carnegie Endowment. She is the editor of Strategic Europe, writing most recently about the European project and the EU, which are now difficult, in fact, impossible to separate from NATO. They're coming to be as one. Judy, a very good day to you in Berlin. The news of the German economy is not fresh to you. You're living in it. But you say that what needs to be done now, as Europe is threatened and at the same time thinking about the Europe project, is to update or replace something called the Monnet process that has to do with assumptions about Russia, about Franco-German relations, about what we now see as a new map of Europe. What is the Monnet process and what does it do now that needs to be updated? Good day to you, Judy.
Good day, John. Thank you for having me on your excellent show. The Monnet process was set up by Jean Monnet, a wonderful politician in the late 1940s, early 1950s, which saw the precursor of today's EU, the European Coal and Steel Community. And Monnet had two philosophies. One was to have an integrated Europe anchored on France and Germany so that there'd be no more war. And secondly, that the European Union, the founding members, would become integrated and move more also towards more integration and even a wider union. But the whole thing would be anchored on a kind of process of consensus of taking into account the member states. That's fine with 6 or 7 countries. That's fine with 12 countries. But now we have 27, and the whole idea of decision making has become not only bureaucratic, but point scoring about trading off deals and so on. And it's become a kind of redundant or anachronistic set of traditions or a set of ways of doing things. It's got to be changed. It's got to be changed by overhauling the voting system and modernizing the EU to deal with these huge, huge challenges, particularly the Russian invasion of Ukraine.
The style, you write in Strategic Europe, is wrangling between the players, especially the large players. That always puzzled me, especially the need for unanimity, guaranteeing wrangling. Was that the original intention, Judy?
Guaranteed wrangling wasn't the original intention. The original intention was to create a kind of level playing field, but also to ensure that the idea of sovereignty of the member states would be acknowledged. And on the other hand, the idea of the community, of the commission, would be acknowledged as well. So it was a kind of special balance between the two. But over the years, we've actually seen a real tussle between the Commission, the executive of the EU, which has power over trade and competition and energy, and the member states, which have enormous powers. And with their voting powers, they can actually sabotage an awful lot and stop an awful lot, or else do good, like imposing sanctions.
Does the EU need a leader? And is it Emmanuel Macron, now re-elected?
I was expecting this question, and I'm actually beginning to rethink this now. France, under Macron, Macron has great ideas, but he doesn't really still consult. He has this big idea of a European integrated union, which is very fine. But what does this mean in terms of the voice of the other countries? I just wonder, given the suspicion of France, particularly by Eastern Europe, and they believe that Macron is a little bit, not sympathetic towards Russia, but gives Putin some of the benefit of the doubt that you can't isolate Russia and humiliate them. I'm not so sure he's the leader. I think what Europe needs is a different constellation of leaderships. The East Europeans must actually come into play on this. The old setup is finished of the six countries, of the 12 big countries. We need a new constellation of influences which will complement each other.
A corollary of this is Russia. Russia, long treated as part of Europe, especially because of the end of the Second War, where Russia was in alliance with the US and the UK and other members of the United Nations. But you write that Europe has had an opinion of Russia as an innocent player. I comment from the American point of view, after the end of the Soviet Union, Russia was treated as a teenager who needed to be instructed, that the pranks and the bad acting was a consequence of poor upbringing. Is that an opinion that is in Europe, is that opinion changing?
Well, that opinion is a rather patronizing one, which the Russians don't like, because the Russians see themselves as a major power under Putin, especially nuclear power. You wouldn't think this given their military performance in Ukraine. But what I was trying to point out was it's the Europeans themselves losing their innocence about Russia, that Russia can be relied upon, that you can have a dialogue with Russia, that you can do business with Russia, not economic business, but serious nuclear proliferation control business. And perhaps this extraordinary war in Ukraine will finally end this European romance, this European innocence about Russia, that it can be part of Europe very easily. And it's not like that. It's much more complex, and Russia has its own agenda. Unfortunately, the member states, like Germany and France, have their own agenda towards Russia as well.
Poland, you present the possibility that the center of the European Union, no longer France and Germany, the Franco-German relationship, but France and Poland. That surprised me, Judy. Is Poland in dialogue with Paris, or would this be fresh wind?
Poland and France have always had an ambiguous, tetchy relationship over the decades. However, over the many centuries, France has been a magnet for Polish emigres settling there, and for Polish ideas and for the Enlightenment. But if Macron wants to reshape Europe, he cannot do it without Poland, particularly, and the other East European countries. Poland is a big country. It's the fifth or sixth largest country inside the EU. If it could get its act together in stop intimidating the judiciary and improving the rule of law, Poland could be a major player, as it was in 2005-2016. I actually stand out on a limb here. I think the Franco-German relationship is important. I think it overstates. I think it's got to move along to a different constellation of leadership structures, because the Franco-German relationship goes back to your initial question. It was based on the Monnet process. And this now is being eclipsed by a much bigger EU, a much more complicated EU, and much more importantly, an Eastern Europe that sees the threats differently from the old member states like Germany and France.
I mentioned that I've been in Krakow several times over these last years before the pandemic, and I was extremely impressed at the young people and how eager they are. The English seemed magical to them, and they were using it excellently, but all European languages were present in Krakow. You know, it's an intellectual town. It's a scholarship town. a great deal of energy. And of course, Polish food is magnificent. So I was surprised that of the alienation between Warsaw and Brussels these last years, has that been healed?
No, it hasn't been healed. One hopes that with the pressure from the United States as well, it will be healed, especially over the way the governing Law and Justice Party has trampled on the judiciary. It's time to end this and have Poland get back on the real path of accountability and the rule of law and an independent judiciary. And this is outdated, it's not necessary. And if Poland could do this, not only would it win credibility inside the EU, plus its huge support for the Ukrainian refugees, it would give Poland the credibility and the say that is absolutely sorely needed in the EU. The whole Franco-German special relationship must be changed with the entree of Poland and some other countries giving fresh ideas, given what's happening in Ukraine.
You write of the brain drain, which I presume was going on before the war, but has now been exacerbated by the Ukrainian population leaving or moving to safety, but also the Russian young people in Russia getting out if they have the means. There's something called the Erasmus program. How does it work, and what do you recommend to encourage young people to go back to the countries they've left?
Yeah, the Erasmus program is just a magical program. It's $26 billion budget over 5 years. Essentially, young people across the EU and in some of the Eastern European countries can apply for scholarship programs, travel programs, study programs, and stay in another EU country for a year or two, study, do their doctorates, do their graduate programs, do their undergraduate programs. It is a wonderful way of mixing the European cultures and identities among young people. Young people want this, and they're more democratically leaning. The downside of this is that this diaspora is so motivated and so well educated that, in fact, they leave behind some regimes, some governments, who are delighted to get rid of them because they're a nuisance. They're democratic. They want accountability. They want the rule of law. They want independent judiciary. They want decent-run institutions. So where they're out of the picture, some governments can say, fine, now we can do what we like, whether it's in the Western Balkans or in parts of Romania or Bulgaria or even Poland. And now I was thinking, maybe because of the vulnerability of the democratic institutions and transformations from communist era to democracy takes an awful long time, why don't we reverse the Erasmus program and use it as a model and invite young, the diaspora, to go back. There's millions of them. Invite them to go back. And yes, there can be incentives. We've got to build up the civil service, pay them properly. Build up the university faculties, pay them properly. Build up the civil society, pay them properly. And this is all about creating strong checks and balances, having a voice against the corruption. And these young people coming back with the experience of democratic practices and implanting them back on their own countries. Maybe it's idealistic, maybe it's utopian, but it's a very interesting idea.
I'm speaking with Judy Dempsey, the editor of Strategic Europe, part of the Carnegie Endowment for Peace. She is in Berlin, and we're observing the EU and what needs to be done now and after the Ukraine conflict is resolved. There is the question of membership in the EU. You will recall that has been a controversy for many decades. Judy has asked distinguished members of the European project. These are scholars at Carnegie and across the continent. Is the EU enlargement a good idea going forward, and how? What is to be done? Does the EU need a new policy? When we come back, I'm John Batchelor.